it records in stereo. Although I don't think stereo adds much to a talk show. Anyway, I suppose if you had a really high voice and I had a really low voice, then it might capture something. But okay, welcome to the Poetry Show on www.enlightenradio.org. And we're broadcasting almost 24/7. Let's make sure we're actually broadcasting now. Yes, we are. We've been broadcasting for the last 41 hours, let's put it that way, without interruption. And the Poetry Show, which my good friend Janet Harrison hosts, goes back off and on for, I don't know, a decade or more. The time at the WSHC college station. I think we did it on Mondays then, too. And now we've tried to restart it. And I see that of all the shows that I publish, you know, I although I don't know the numbers entirely on Banny's show, but people are downloading the Poetry Show. It's interesting. All right. And today I'm going to let Janet introduce the topic, since it was postponed from last week because I got three different shots in one day and it just wiped me out. So anyway, today, by the way, one other point, if you want to be listening on a regular basis and you move over to your phone, you know, the webpage doesn't always show the player, but there's a separate link called player.enlightenradio.org, which always has the player playing, and well, whenever you click the play button. So that said, Janet, tell us what the Poetry Show is going to consider today.
We're going to continue the theme from last week of Ars Poetica and look at people who have written about the art of poetry in poems, and finish up with some prose, actually, from Letters to a Young Poet by Rilke. But we're going to start out with W.S. Merwin, who was a contemporary poet, died recently at an advanced age, wrote up until the end, an amazing poet. And he was a student of John Berryman. And John Berryman is noted as one of the poets that were found in the confessional poetry book, where people wrote about, used material from their own life and wrote. He was very influential on Anne Sexton and Robert Lowell and other people of that school. He won prizes for a sequence of poems where he uses a poetic persona, Henry, which is a thinly disguised for himself, called Dream Songs. So Berryman is, but he was also known for hard drinking and ruined his life that way.
Yeah.
Committed suicide at the end of his life by jumping off a bridge in Minnesota. So this is about Berryman, and it's by W.S. Merwin, and it's reflecting on his time when he was Berryman's student. Berryman, I will tell you what he told me in the years just after the war, as we then called the Second War. Don't lose your arrogance yet, he said. You can do that when you're older. Lose it too soon, and you may merely replace it with vanity. Just one time, he suggested, changing the usual order of the same words in a line of verse. Why point out the same thing twice? He suggested I pray to the muse, get down on my knees and pray right there in the corner, and he said he meant it literally. It was in the days before the beard and the drink, but he was deep in the tides of his own, through which he sailed chin sideways and head tilted like a tacking sloop. He was far older than dates allowed for, much older than I was. He was in his 30s. He snapped down his nose with an accent I think he affected in England. And as for publishing, he advised me to paper my wall with rejection slips. His lips and bones of long fingers trembled with the vehemence of his views about poetry. He said the great presence that permitted everything and transmuted it in poetry was passion. Passion was genius, and he praised movement and invention. I had hardly begun to read. I asked, how can you ever be sure that what you write is really any good at all? And he said, you can't. You can't, and you can never be sure. You die without knowing whether anything you wrote was any good. And if you have to be sure, don't write.
It sounds like a contemporary of Jack Kerouac.
Yes.
A little bit. I always liked his poetry, and I think that Merwin, he captures its spirit. He really does, you know.
Yes.
It's very nice. Very, very nice. And also, I mean, there's a certain quality to the imagery that Merwin uses a lot, where he plays a trick on you. There was an example earlier in that poem. I should have the written version in front of me, but he holds something out for you, and then it does a disappearing act. And he's instantly, something is mutated into something different. And it's very, for example, one of the other poems I was just talking about with you that I did read this morning on the subject of poetry, he has something that he seems to do. It's almost mystical or completely hypothetical. I'm not quite sure if the right magical. Maybe magical is the right word. There's like magical changes that take place in his poems. Seems to me. What do you think?
I think so too. I think there's something very. I thought this was such a lovely tribute to a teacher in poetry, and I think now might be a good time to read Merwin's Ars Poetica, which is his statement about poetry.
Yeah, I mean the one I was.
We weren't planning on reading, but I think that'd be really a good time for it.
Okay, well then I have that in front of me if it's okay. All right.
Sure.
You want me to go ahead? Okay. So on the subject of poetry. I do not understand the world, Father. By the mill pond at the end of the garden, there's a man who slouches, listening to the wheel revolving in the stream. Only there is no wheel to revolve. He sits in the end of March, but he also sits in the end of the garden. His hands are in his pockets. It is not expectation on which he is intent, nor yesterday to which he listens. It is a wheel turning. When I speak, Father, it is the world that I must mention. He does not move his feet, nor so much as raise his head, for fear he should disturb the sound he hears, like a pain without a cry. Where he listens, I do not think I am fond, Father, of the way in which he always, before he listens, he prepares himself by listening. It is unequal, Father, like the reason for which the wheel turns, though there is no wheel. I speak of him, Father, because he is there with his hands in his pocket, in the end of the garden, listening to the turning wheel that is not there. But it is the world, Father, that I do not understand. I think that's very cool.
Yeah, it is. It's a really cool poem.
And
that repetition of the wheel not being there.
And
the listening to it.
Right, right. Uh-huh. Yeah. It almost gives you a little buzz. I don't know how to explain. Maybe if we had our listeners online, maybe some could hearken. And the use of the word father. Imagine you could write that, rewrite that poem and eliminate the word father.
Yeah.
And
it would be a different poem.
It would be a different poem. Well, a lot of the poem would still be there.
Mm-hmm.
But having the father there, that it just adds a dimension, a whole dimension to it that, you know, we're asking a question of our ancestors or of God. Right, because you could put a capital F in the father, and it wouldn't change the meaning. It would change the poem too. Maybe not as much as leaving it out altogether, but a single word in there. And like you said, the wheel that is not there. I mean, that's like a Ray Bradbury kind of image.
It is kind of a Twilight Zone-y image.
Yeah.
Of someone there intently listening to something that's not there. And that kind of is sort of like a metaphor what we do for poetry. We're listening for what's beyond.
Right.
And we're trying to transmit it.
Well, like staring, like you were saying last week or 2 weeks ago, I'm sorry, about staring at the blank page.
Yes.
You know, that. And that's maybe a similar moment as listening to the wheel that's not there. Anyway, I love it. W.S. Merwin.
We had two poems from W.S. Merwin. Now we're going to switch tone totally, but still get some good advice from poetry. And this is from Robert Graves. And Robert Graves is probably most known for his memoir that he wrote after World War I, Goodbye to All That, where he left England and went to live, was it in Majorca? I can't remember now. He went to live on one of the islands.
Yeah, that sounds like a Jersey Spanish J. Majorca or Mallorca?
Mallorca, I don't know.
I don't know. I know in Jersey it would be Majorca, but whatever. All right. Are you going to read this one?
Yeah, this is Devil's Advice to Storytellers. It's one of my favorite poems of all time. And it's written for prose, but it's by Robert Graves, like I said, who also wrote Goodbye to All That. The Devil's Advice to Storytellers. Lest men suspect your tale to be untrue, keep probability, some say, in view. But my advice to storytellers is, weigh out no gross of probabilities, nor yet make diligent transcriptions of known instances of virtue, crime, or love. To forge a picture that will pass for true, do conscientious what liars do. Born liars, not the lesser sort that raised the mouth of others for their stock and trade. Assemble first all casual bits and scraps that may shake down into a world, perhaps. People this world by chance created so, with random persons whom you do not know. The tea shop short, or travelers in a train, seen once, guessed idly at, not seen again. Let the erratic course they steer surprise their own and your reader's eyes. Sigh then, or frown, but leave, as in despair, motive and end and moral in the air. Nice contradiction between fact and fact will make the whole read human and exact.
Yeah, that close is perfect. You know, I think that should be a political slogan there.
Nice contradiction between fact and fact.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a well. maybe the other earlier part too about let the erratic course they steer surprise with their own and your own and your reader's eyes. Sigh then or frown, but leave as in despair. Motive and end and moral in the air. Right.
So this rhymes. Graves was a formalist in many of his poems, but the rhymes are so subtle that they don't hit you on the head, even though they're exact rhymes.
Well, until he gets a fact and exact, I mean, it works well, partly because they are so close, and in some cases, in other cases, not so. Like, you know, reader's eyes and surprise, I mean, it's a true rhyme, but the words are very different, you know, and so it's... And I always liked rhymes like that, where the rhyme is adding something substantial, at least it seems, that would not be there otherwise if it did not rhyme. Maybe that doesn't make any sense. That's kind of but I sometimes think about it, you know, well, if I read that sentence and there was no rhyme there at the end, what would change? And in this case, there's quite a bit of humor and, I don't know, indirection that is added by the rhymes. He has it has a meter too, right? I mean, it's
yes.
Yeah. So it's not a complicated rhyme scheme.
No, it's a
BB, right?
AABB.
CC. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and which is normally, to do rhyming couplets like that is normally very hard. It normally gets very sing-songy, but this poem is anything but sing-songy.
Well, you notice how he makes the sentence context structure more complex.
Mm-hmm.
And that keeps it from being sing-songy, too. I mean, he has a... You know, one that really drew my attention was, to forge a picture that will pass for true, do conscientiously what liars do, born liars, not the lesser sort that raid the mouths of others for their stock in trade. You know, the sentence structures are not simple.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes the rhymes not be like, I wish that I could see a poem as beautiful as a tree. Or anyway, okay. Well, do you have another, launch into... this world of poetical imagination for us today?
Well, there's a very famous book that Rilke wrote, and he didn't intend it to be a book. It's a series of letters that he wrote to a poet who was writing to him. And you don't have the poet's letters, you just have Rilke's replies. And it's called Letters to a Young Poet. Now, I was going to read an excerpt from the first. This is prose, but it's about the art of poetry. I was going to read an excerpt from the first letter that he writes back to this young poet who wrote to him.
I don't know whether Rilke can write true prose or not. I mean, his prose is so close to poetry that sometimes you wonder. go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay, so this is from the first letter, Letters to a Young Poet. It's written, of course, in German, and so it's translated. This particular translation is Stephen Levine's translation, which is a very colloquial, very free-flowing translation. And it starts out, you ask whether your verses are any good. Now, remember what Berryman said to Merwin about that. If you need to know if it's any good, don't write. but this is the response that Rilke has. You ask whether your verses are any good. You ask me. You have asked others before this. You send them to magazines. You compare them with other poems, and you're upset when certain editors reject your work. Now, since you have said you want my advice, I beg you to stop doing that sort of thing. You are looking outside, and that is what you should most avoid right now. No one can advise or help you. No one. There is only one thing you should do. Go into yourself. Find out the reason that commands you to write and see whether it has spread its roots into the very depths of your heart. Confess to yourself whether you would have to die if you were forbidden to write. This most of all, ask yourself in the most silent hour of your night, must I write? Dig into yourself for a deep answer. And if this is an answer that rings out in assent, if you meet this solemn question with a strong, simple, I must, then build your life in accordance with your necessity. Your whole life, even unto its humblest and most indifferent hour, must become a sign and a witness to this impulse.
Right, as usual, reading Rilke is like visiting a neighboring star.
Yes.
You know our mutual friend, Marie Tyler McGraw?
Yes.
Well, she once, I recall my reaction to this kind of poem by Rilke, you know, this kind of the mission to be a writer and how far you must and how deeply one must commit. Marie one time was listening to some version, I think it was the one that I was reading, of the Fisher of Men parable from, you know, the New Testament, where Peter is challenging Jesus about whether it's, you know, safe to fish out in the deep. Anyway, and everybody's supposed to go and be fishers of men after they learned the lesson. And I remember Marie saying, well, what are their wives supposed to do? So, you know, there's a, I hear a little bit of that in Rilke, you know. But I'm glad he took the trip he did, because his gift was to us all.
Yes, and later on in the book, he talks about literary criticism.
Right, right.
Which is kind of interesting. He says, read as little as possible of literary criticism. Such things are either partisan opinions, which have become petrified, meaningless, hardened and empty of life, or else they are just clever word games in which one view wins today and tomorrow the opposite view. Works of art are of an infinite solitude, and by no means approach is so useless as criticism. Only love can touch and hold them and be fair to them. Always trust yourself and your own feeling, as opposed to argumentations, discussions, or introductions of that sort. If it turns out you are wrong, then the natural growth of your inner life will eventually guide you to other insights. Allow your judgments their own silent, undisturbed development, which, like all progress, must come from deep within and cannot be forced or hasty. Everything is gestation and then birthing.
Yeah.
So they didn't teach that in our MFA.
Well, you know, I mean, Rilke, the intensity of Rilke is very difficult to equal or even measure. It's something else. And but you know, I can, his poems stay with me for a lifetime. So I don't begrudge him the intensity, even though I think, for example, it's not all just gestation. I mean, there is education from experience, from relationships, from the knowledge of others being shared. That's, you know, although one, having spent three or four years in literary criticism, I can certainly sympathize with you about that. Other than the historical kinds of writing in literary, well, cultural criticism that I think does have a lot of value and is worth doing. But you're right, but he's right about, you know, these formalist versus new criticism versus symbolic versus Freudian versus, you know, some decompositional thing. Reducing it to, you know, elementary phonemes, turning it into a vector database. So, you know, I'm just now, see, you can just get all the way from literary criticism to AI in a few steps.
Yes, you managed it.
Right. So, well, I think it's just, this is one, this is great. I love that essay. I can't remember reading something from Rilke I didn't like or wasn't moved by. What's your reaction to it, actually?
I think the idea of the artist needing solitude is true of some artists and less true of other artists. I think poems can be written in solitude and also poems can be written in community. And I think both are valid. But I think Rilke took this very intense idea of an artist and as art growing in the dark subconscious and then emerging when it's mature. I think he took that very seriously. And his work has a depth because of it, because of the solitude that he took himself to, even though he had relationships.
Right.
Well, there's a deep, resonance of solitude in his poetry, I think.
Yes, I think you're right. I mean, and even the most, some of the most moving ones. Well, I always remember the one he wrote about the death of Moses, which can almost bring you to tears. You know, on the other hand, for example, I was thinking of the one interesting aspect of his intensity of his language is that it survives translation better than many.
Yeah.
And I'm not quite sure why, because when I think of another comparable poet of, you know, that had global sense, I think of Pablo Neruda, right, who I don't think... whose gift came from a much more community base of relationships, and every day was different, and odes to all kinds of things in his town or forest or beach or in that kind of thing, you know, and, or people or politics. So the Spanish Civil War or this historical subjects. So it's not the only way to be, and but Neruda also had a just unbelievable intensity of language.
Yes.
And I think part of the reason why his poems also survive in translation, you know, very well around the world, is that you know, he. The richness of the vocabulary, in a way, kind of compels the translator to reach pretty deep, you know, to find a word or short expression that can replace both some kind of context, or it mimics some kind of context in the original. It even makes the translation of those poems stand out. Even from different translators, I remember having read maybe three, four, maybe even a couple more different translations of Rilke's famous poem, The Panther. We don't need to read here. And also folk songs, like with Bruce Coburn, who wrote one about it. And they're all good, you know, in English, I mean. But folks who know German better always tell me that, well, they are, but they're even better in German. So there you go.
That's a short discussion of writing poetry. Three of them in poem, and one section of prose readings from Rilke, who, as John points out, can't write prose even if he tries.
Right. All right.
But I thought they were very moving.
Me too. A great selection, Janet. And are we done for the day for this edition of the Poetry Show? Okay. All right. Well, I hope you have a good day. Let me know if you need anything. Carol's downtown, but Kathy is here with us today, so until the weekend. Anyway, so take care. All right. It's late, but everything comes next.